Welcome to the Indie Creator Spotlight. My name is Walt, and today we have a creator that we have long had in the crosshairs, the creative force behind Unstoppable Comics, Mr. J. DiRosario. How are you, sir?
I'm very good. Thanks for having me, Walt. I appreciate being here.
I really appreciate you coming on. Did I say your name correctly?
Yes, that's it. That's it. J. DiRosario, on the money.
Well, I just wanted to get it right. As somebody who speaks a few languages other than English, I can murder a person's name, surprisingly enough.
You know, I always want to learn Japanese, man. I speak English, I speak Spanish, I know a little bit of patois, and just some French, but the dirty stuff.
C'est bon and todo bien aquí. So, there we go.
Are you with me to the next Puerto Rico Comic Con?
Don't threaten me with a good time. So, Jay, tell us a little bit about yourself. Where are you from originally?
Well, I'm from Boston, New York, born and raised. Spent a little time living in Puerto Rico, a little time living in Virginia, and then came back home to New York a few years back. Let's just say that. Time frames are a little messed up, but I've been around and grew up reading comic books, you know, from the quarter bin at the little corner store, and loved them ever since, and now I'm here.
Nice. What brought you to Puerto Rico?
Family, brother. My mom and my dad from out there, and after my granddad retired, he bought a little farm out there where my cousins and I would go on summer vacations, and it was a nice escape from the city. You know, we got a little bit of the farm life out there and learned how to ride horses, take care of goats, cattle, pigs, you know, some outdoorsy stuff that you don't get to learn when you're in the city every day.
Absolutely. That sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
You said you started on those quarter bins at the corner store. You talking about those spinner racks?
Dude, spinner racks, yes. The racks that were bolted against the door. See, by my grandmother's place in Brooklyn, there was a small little bodega, and the guy who owned it would sell his son's secondhand comics, you know, for a quarter. And to keep me happy, my grandmother would give me a buck. I'd run downstairs, pick up four books, and, you know, I kept my mouth shut, and I was entertained all day. You know, I was out of her hair. And, dude, that was my world, man. You know, that was my world. And I grew up reading things that maybe I shouldn't have, that I wasn't ready for. You know, some early Hellblazer stuff before Vertigo, some Doctor Strange stuff when it was a two-parter with Cloak and Dagger. I remember they shared a title for a while.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, dude, you know. But then I also got my hands on some pre-crisis DC stuff, you know, and early Marvel. And, dude, I had a bevy of comic books at my disposal as a kid, so I was lucky in that regard.
So it sounds like your comic tastes crossed party lines. Did you have a favorite as a kid?
Dude, it was Cap. Cap was always my favorite, man.
Nice.
You know, I always hear people talk about, you know, they suffered through the Spider-Clone saga. Well, I suffered through the Cat-Wolf saga. That was the travesty there, you know? The Cat-Wolf saga, that was hard. That was hard to take. You know, that was something you had to get down with if you were a fan of Cat.
Yeah. Did you see they redid it recently?
They did?
Yeah, about 6 months ago, a year ago, maybe.
Oh, with the Falcon?
Yeah, it was tragic.
I'm glad I missed out on that. You know, I'm at a point where I don't pick up on a monthly basis anymore. I'm picking up trades, you know, so
yeah.
I'm behind on a lot of stuff.
Yeah, I get all that stuff on the Marvel Unlimited app, so it's really good for not having to suffer through it as it comes out.
See, I don't even have the time to do that, you know. To be honest, to do the Wednesday pickup, it's become like a job. Yeah, I got enough of those. I got I got two of them. So, you know, I guess my comic reading has turned into the Netflix binge watching. You know,
yes.
I'll just pick up a couple trades, and on the weekend, you know, I'll try to catch up on something that interests me, you know.
Absolutely.
So what are you reading these days?
I'm picking up a lot of the early Hellboy stuff.
Nice.
Dude, his Mike Mignola's take on mythology was just, dude, that's like some wild, trippy stuff, man. He had to be smoking something good. Stories. I didn't know what I had been missing out on, you know? So there was that. I tried to pick up that Civil War II, and I just, it didn't sit well with me, so I passed on that. And what was this thing from Boom Studios that it was the Paul Jenkins 12-issue series where he had the superheroes fighting Death Battle? That was nice, man.
Really?
Yeah. The ending was a little weird. But you know, it was a brand new set of heroes, so anything could happen. And that's one of the great things with like indie comics, you know? It's a brand new tapestry of entertainment that hasn't been touched upon. That you don't have to backtrack with it 60 years worth of stuff to get a hold of the characters.
Absolutely. And that's kind of why we started this show. There's so much great stuff out there and content being created by indie publishers that it seemed like the right thing to do, that we had to get out there and spotlight it. So when did you decide that you wanted to give up sleep and money and become an indie comics publisher?
All right. So you ready for this?
Yes, sir.
So in the late 90s, turn of 2000s, I had the idea, and I started with the team concept for the Storm Chasers. And the first three issues I did were crap, dude. They were garbage, right? And I started doing the fourth one, and I got involved with a young lady. We ended up shacking up, buying property, and I put comics to bed for a little while. And then in 2011, 2010, things went south. And dude, I hit rock bottom. You know, we split up, and I was like, I was in this big bout of depression. I wasn't gonna do anything stupid, but I wasn't lifting my head off the pillow.
Right.
You know. So I had those three books, and then I had the fourth issue of the Storm Chasers that was nearly completed. And then I was putting together a character guide, and I had my sister and my best friend. They just, you know, they knew comics had always been, you know, my safety blanket, you know, my go-to, my warm apple pie.
Nice.
And they told me, you know, New York Comic Con was coming up at that time. They're like, why don't you just try, see what you can do. So, whatever, I grabbed a couple bucks that I had in my pocket since I wasn't paying a mortgage anymore. And I put down for a table at the New York Comic Con, which, for anybody to be their first Comic Con where they're exhibiting, wow. Talk about jumping into the deep end of the pool without knowing how to swim, right? But, you know, people were buying the books, and as shitty as they were, they saw something there. And they saw a level of progression from the first issue to the fourth issue. And they were supporting me at that moment by buying the books, right? But they weren't just buying the books. They were buying a piece of me. And it did a lot to reestablish my confidence. It did a lot to get me out of that funk of depression that I was in. And after the con, I was like, you know, this can't be it. If this is the last thing I ever do, this can't be what I leave out there, you know? So I had to do something better, and it started snowballing from four issues of that to this catalog of almost 30-something books between four different titles of me learning how to make comic books. So it's not like, you know, I said, oh, I have to do this. It's more like, people spend money on me, so I have to give them something better than I did the last time. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. So when you brought out Storm Chasers, you were the writer. How did you come up with the concept? Was it something that was around for a long time, or did you slowly work into it and then released it in its first form? Because I want to talk about Redo.
Yeah. Well, when in its first form, I always thought that was going to be my resume. You know, I put together something that I was not really emotionally invested in, that I can use as a resume. I can show off to people, and hopefully that would land me a gig somewhere. But all it ended up doing was making me feel like Oliver Twist asking for more porridge, sir, you know, and people saying, get this shit, garbage away from me.
Oh, if you want to go explicit, rock on.
I'm sorry, I'm from New York, bro. I got the mouth of a sailor. I got to watch that sometimes.
Oh, I got you. I spent many years in the military, so I swear like a sailor on fire.
Yeah. So, you know, we gotta learn how to tame that. You know, we gotta temper that. But so that was originally intended to be my resume. You know, and then I started to get invested in the characters because why write a story without caring about what you're writing about? And when I got to that fourth issue, I was like, okay. They serve their purpose, but I'm telling a story, and these characters just aren't the proper fit for the story. So in the fifth issue is where I introduced a brand new set of characters.
Uh-huh.
So I guess a better story, but I still didn't know what I was doing. You know, I never should have jumped into the deep end of the pool without knowing how to swim at all, because... there were sharks in there also, you know what
yeah.
I mean? And they were eating you up. But little by little, I've learned, and hopefully I've put out a better product. And that's when we came to the Storm Chasers Redux. I felt like, not that I know everything. I still know nothing. But I knew a lot more than I did when I put together that first Storm Chasers issue. So I felt I owed it to the people who had been supporting me up to that point to do something up to the level that I was capable of doing at that moment.
And in keeping with that, finding an artist, did you find that that was difficult, or did you find that you fell, you kind of fell into it? Because you said you started in 2011, so the internet had already risen to prominence as the essential cat-finding tool for pictures all over the place. How did you go about that?
It started off on digital webbing. The forums there, you had forums of people who were looking for artists, for writers, for inkers, colors, everything. And I would just put out ads. And I met a few people. I met Craig Shepard, who did the Dragonstone book with me. And he did a bunch of the trading cards that are available now. But the key was finding the colorist, Michael Summers, who is about 95% of the books that I've put out.
Nice.
And through his network, he introduced me to Russ Leach. And Russ did his first book with me was Storm Chasers number 5.
Mm-hmm.
And we bonded at that moment. You know, we did we bounced a lot of ideas off of each other. And Russ became an invaluable tool to help Unstoppable Comics get some stability and a level of artwork that was credible, you know?
Absolutely.
Now, with Storm Chasers being the flagship title and you having some success with that, you start branching out. We start noticing around that time that you come out with Dragonstorm. And where did that come from? Was that a love of kung fu action theater and those movie marathons they used to have on Saturdays? Can you talk a bit about that?
Of course I did. Kung Fu Theater was the way to go, you know? But it also came from a love of two more characters. I mean, Cap was my all-time favorite, but Iron Fist and Nightwing both held a special heart, a place in my heart, you know? Iron Fist, I was felt in the early 80s, was so underserved, you know?
Yeah.
I remember when he came back in the pages of Namor, the Submariner by John Byrne, and I was like, oh my God, I need to have more of this. And I consumed everything I could that had Iron Fist, and then you had Nightwing, and to get into DC Marvel politics, right? The thing for me with DC was the Sky Kids grew up.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's how I was always able to define it. And one of my favorite earliest books ever was that Teen Titans cover, where Dick Grayson and Wally West are walking away, and their sidekick clothes are shown behind them.
Yeah.
You know, and that was done, you know, growing up. So for me, I grew up with Nightwing. You know, the early Teen Titans was elementary school. The George Perez Wolfman era was high school. You know, the Tom Grummett era, I guess, was early college. If anybody else associates it that way, then I guess we're on the same level. If not, then thank you for not being as crazy as I am.
Yeah. Where did the idea for Dragonstorm come from?
A little bit of kung fu, a little bit of mythology. See, a lot of my stuff is based on mythology. You know, I was coming up with a story for why Atlantis had sunk. I know it's weird. I know it has no association with martial arts at all. But you know, the idea of, well, you know, what if when Atlantis sunk, there were dragons that was trying to keep it from sinking? And what if, you know, there was a battle that the dragons had with whatever over Atlantis, and, you know, the disappearance of the dragons with the disappearance of Atlantis were tied into each other, and what happened to the people on the island? So one thing led to another, and I said, oh, well, you know, if there were people on Atlantis that lived with dragons, they worked with them, they coexisted with them, were they Buddhists, you know, were they monks, were they followers, were they disciples, and what if there was someone that is still a surviving member of that order today, and that's where the concept of Dragonstorm germinated from.
Nice. Now, do you have you trained in martial arts at all?
No, but I've been beaten by quite a few people.
Yeah, we spoke a little bit earlier of your lengthy resume of concussions that might be in your medical file.
I did do some boxing in the PAL, and you know, I caught a couple shots there, but martial arts, no.
Gotcha.
So you have Storm Chasers out, and by this point, Unstoppable Comics has several issues for the series, and you decide to do a 1.5 at Kickstarter, which is where I first encountered you, and it all started with a cover.
Okay.
So I can remember it vividly. It started with an ad, and you guys had that very iconic cover. It was the full image that would eventually be the wraparound cover for the front and back of the comic book.
Right.
And in that image, you had all of the characters that would become a part of the Storm Chasers universe. They're charging, storming, if you will, toward the viewer. There's all sorts of mayhem breaking loose, but the heroes are here, and they're going to handle it. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, okay. Well, Redux, I touched on it a little bit, was my way of saying to the people that supported me, you know what, I'm a better writer, I'm a better creator, I'm a better storyteller, I'm a better entertainer than I was when I first started this. So hopefully, if you've been on the ride with me this long, then you'll enjoy the new interpretation of that very first story, which never should have came out to begin with. If it never come out, you know, I never would have learned those lessons. I never would have gotten this. And somebody put me on the Kickstarter. Excuse me. The book before that was the Interceptor book that was going to be done in a two-part piece together, written by Brandon Easton, and it failed. It failed. It made a lot of money, but it never hit its goal, and I learned a valuable Kickstarter lesson that I didn't know what the hell I was doing. So I had the Redux, you know, in the barrel, ready to launch. So I said, okay, let me take the lessons that I learned from this failure and see if I can apply better techniques to this. And it worked. And, you know, I found new people such as yourself.
Nice.
And it set me on a path to being a Kickstarter addict. Yeah, I put out the last six. Well, this is the sixth book right now through Kickstarter, and it's doing okay, you know. And it's, I don't know, everybody looks at it a different way, you know. And I look at Kickstarter as a sales platform. I know a lot of people say not to, but when you want to look for indie comics today, where are you going to look for them? Are you looking for them on Comixology? Are you looking on your local comic shop? Or are you looking for an indie comic book on Kickstarter?
Yes, absolutely.
You know, that's the spot. That's where people are going to find you. And if you're not on some crowdfunding platform to push your book, then you're missing the boat, in my opinion.
Absolutely.
So as an aside, not having to do with Kickstarter or the current campaigns. God, we had an image about a year ago, someone doing cosplay of Star Striker.
Yeah! Yeah!
How cool was that to have one of your characters cosplay?
Oh, dude, what? I bowed to him. Like, you seriously love my stuff that much that you got a... And he's like, yeah, man. He's like, I'm ready to ride the wave with you.
Yeah.
And if you are, then, you know, I got your back all the way down, you know? And we'll either look good when the ride is over, or we'll crash and burn together.
Nice.
So he's done two conventions with me, dressed up as Star Striker. And funny enough, he went to the Puerto Rico Comic Con this year.
Really?
And he dressed up as Star Striker, and I'm like, dude, you're the freaking man, you know? So he's going to be back at the New York Comic Con with me this year, and we're looking to tie in a little gimmick during the convention weekend. I guess it's not a Where's Waldo thing, but if you can find him on the convention floor, you take a picture with him, you know, you tweet us or you tag us on Facebook, or whatever, and you know, you come back to the booth, and I got a poster waiting for you. You know.
Oh man, that's pretty cool.
We'll see how that works out.
Nice.
Hopefully, get some people involved. He's a cool dude. David is he's a great dude. I don't know if you've ever seen him before, but David is dressed up as he's dressed up as Ares. He's dressed up as Black Bolt. He's dressed up as Captain America in the new uniform, where it has that instead of the chainmail, it's, you know, that shell padding.
Yes.
That's on his chest. Yeah,
yep.
He's done Iron Fist. If you look him up on Facebook, I think his page is Cap Santiago, or look on ShopOverComics.com. I got pictures with him in his different cosplay outfits.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, dude, he's a cool dude. He's a cool dude, man.
Now, one of the things I really loved because about Storm Chasers that I picked up on Kickstarter, I said to myself, this looks like a pretty good story. I want to see where this is going. So I went out and I picked up most of your catalog on that day.
Thank you.
One of the things I loved, especially reading the character guides, was you had a very multinational cast. You look in the character guides, and you know there are flags from every nation in there. You even had an interesting character, Quetzalcoatl. And you actually used that word and spelled it out.
I give you the phonetic pronunciation underneath his name as a tagline.
And I got to tell you, I was half hoping to look through some of these character guides and in hopes that you were going to use a Mockoweedl in some. And for those listeners that don't know what that is, it's a wooden sword with obsidian razor blades going down the side of it that are all glued together by, like, animal glue. And it was used by Aztec warriors in the ancient world.
Dude, if there was a way that I could incorporate it where it wouldn't sound as confusing to the readers, then there. You know what I mean? It's not as simple as saying Mjolnir, the Thor's hammer.
Right.
So can you talk a little bit about the multinational cast that appears in your books and how that all came about?
Well, that all goes back to me reading books as a kid. You know,
and being from New York, too.
Yeah, being from New York, you know, my parents were from Puerto Rico, and, you know, I'm 100% American, but growing up, you know, you were either in comic books. You were either black, white, or Asian. You know, there weren't other characters of different nationalities in the book. I mean, there was White Tiger, right,
mm-hmm.
in Marvel. And I don't know what you know about Puerto Rico, but I can guarantee you there are no tigers on the island. It's martial arts, you know, the national pastime. So it's like, where did you find that connection? So I grew up reading Captain America, Batman, stuff like that. And it wasn't that, you know, I didn't find ethnic identity with them. I found something I was able to relate to. But I also noticed that, you know, the people in the books that looked like me, my friends, the people in the neighborhood, the people at school, my teachers, people on the bus, it didn't look like New York. It didn't look like New York, you know, and stable, you know, I know a lot of people outside of New York have a lot of heat with New York, but you know, it is a melting pot. You know, you come to New York and you'll get a fuck you because of who you are before you get a fuck you throwing your nationality. You know what I mean?
Yep, absolutely.
And I grew up with that. So I'm like, if there's somebody out there that grew up like me looking for that, then I gotta find some way, now that I have the opportunity to give them something to identify with.
Yeah, and best use of a superhero or supervillain name ever is your use of the character of Thunderbelly.
Tell me that's not great, dude. That's based on one of my buddies, man. Thing, you know? We grab a couple beers, he sits back, he pulls up his shirt, he'll slap his belly, and he'll let something out. You know, I just don't know if it's from the top or the bottom.
We've seen a lot of the main characters in your stories make their debut inside the pages of Storm Chasers. What led to the new story direction that you were talking about earlier, the new story direction for Storm Chasers number 5?
I didn't feel, as a creator, the connection to some of those earlier characters from the first three Storm Chasers books.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if I was going to take a serious stab at it, then I needed something I feel that I was interested in writing. I was interested in creating. I was interested in seeing the path that these characters would take. You know, that's why I dispatched so many of the earlier characters so quickly. You know, they either bit the bullet or they got incapacitated very easily, which was an easy way of writing them out of the book.
Got it.
So I got this new batch, and then the fun part is now trying to tear their lives apart, I guess.
And speaking of tearing lives apart, this is around the time you start going to Kickstarter with being able to delve deeper into the characters, we start seeing the unstoppable origins.
Yeah.
And the one that brought me into the Unstoppable Origins line was I came in on number 4 with Dr. Zero.
Dr. Zero.
What brought Unstoppable Origins around? What made you go in that direction?
You know, I deal with a large tapestry of characters, and I made readers aware, I hope, that there was a world that existed before they picked up that first issue, or that Storm Chasers Redux issue. You know, there were things that happened prior to them getting involved with these books. So exploring those concepts could have been done within the Storm Chasers book without taking away from what was happening there. So with the Origins title, I was able to step out of time, I guess, you know, step out of, not time, what's the word I'm looking here for?
Step out of the continuity?
There we go, that's it, step out of continuity, and tell something within the confines of those pages, you know, a complete story, which hopefully adds to your enjoyment of the overall Unstoppable Comics universe.
Absolutely.
So with the Origin series of books, if people are interested in picking those up, is there a certain order you should read those in? Can they start at one and then go to another, or should they read them in order?
They can pick up any one. Number one is its own self-contained story. Number 2 and 3 is its own story. And number 4 is its own story. So you don't have to pick up 1, 2, 3, and 4 to follow one complete tale. You could jump in at any point and know that what you're picking up in that issue is going to be contained to that issue.
Right on.
Now, we saw Interceptor kind of debut during the Storm Chaser storyline. We saw him come in at a point where you were turning stories over. And this is the part where we see Kickstarter launch for Interceptor number 1.
Yeah.
But now we have a change in what's actually on the front cover, because now we have Brandon Easton doing the writing. Was it hard to turn over your property to another writer?
No, because I was going stir crazy with trying to keep everything in line. You know, I mean, the thing is, you're not just an indie comic book creator, you know? You're wearing, it's going to sound like a cliche, but you're wearing all these hats.
Yeah.
You know, you're a writer, you're an editor, you're a marketer, you're a salesman, you are a human resource person, you know, you're looking for new talent. You're doing all these things, and you're still trying to pay your bills at the same time. You've got a day job, and you're going bonkers trying to keep it all together. So I wanted to push off more on Interceptor. That's why he showed up in the first Origins, Unstoppable Origins book. Mm-hmm. So I met Brandon at a New York Comic Con, and, you know, he'd been reading some of the books, and he was interested, and then I told him my take, and he was like, oh, my God, I know exactly where you should go with this.
Nice.
And, you know, he laid out those first two issues, which gave me a hell of a breather, man. You know, it let me get my house in order, and as well as my personal life.
Yeah.
You know, and it brought a lot of these people over that were interested in my stuff. And, you know, some of them stayed and are still pushing for us, you know, still supporting us. So, his assistance is invaluable.
Nice.
Yeah.
One of the great things about Interceptor is that now you're jumping the pond. So going over to such a mythology-rich environment and dealing with Avalon and the weapons of Avalon and Arthurian mythos.
Oh, dude. All right. So it wasn't just, you know, I grew up a geek kid, man. You know, it wasn't just comic books. I loved the Avalonian take on the TV series Gargoyles. Do you remember that?
Oh, of course I do.
You know, the way they even handled Macbeth, you know, they swove that into a Midsummer Night's Dream and all that. I was like, oh my God. It just doesn't have to be structured to Shakespeare, you know? And I incorporated that into Interceptor. It's like Interceptor didn't just start with Interceptor, right? I want to go back to Captain America. Do you remember the introduction of John Walker?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
So John Walker's sidekick was Leon Hopkins, right? And he ended up calling himself Battlestar, right? And I was like, oh, you know, it's always interesting. They didn't explore much about him in the Cap books at that point, but then he ended up jumping over to the Silver Sable book for the little while that it was going on, and he was a big supporting character there. So I followed him. I was like, oh man, they stopped using him. So when I was coming up with different characters for Storm Chasers number 5, you know, I wanted to come up with somebody. I wanted to come up with a shield slinger, plain and simple. It's a common archetype, you know. It's a strong archetype, but I didn't want to go the Captain America route, right? I needed something that was, all right, Cap Shield is born of science, right? What's the opposite of that? Mask. Okay, so that's where it started to germinate. All right, the Shield is born of mask. What's out there in mythology that is magic? That's a weapon, you know. That's from England. Okay, Excalibur. Oh, all right, but this is a shield, right? But what happened to when they made Excalibur? You know, you always hear sword and shield. Was there a shield that was ever made? And I never found any reference to it, so I'm like, oh my God, there's this hole there, this opening that doesn't have this strict mythological structure that I can jump into and exploit. And we went from there with it.
Nice.
Interceptor number 3 is on Kickstarter right now, and we're starting to see a lot of the preview art come out of that. One of the more eye-catching images is of a new character named Daybreaker, and she's sporting a weapon that has been identified as the Hammer of Prometheus.
Yeah!
Oh, you know there's going to be a story here.
Yeah. All right, I'm making no bones about... my stuff is definitely influenced from early Marvel, early DC, right?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the big things that both DC and Marvel had was that team of four, right? Mm-hmm. You either had the Challengers or you had the Fantastic Four. I'm like, you know, well, that's a gap that's missing in this little world that I'm building here, right? Where's that family functioning team of four? And I was watching The Quick and the Dead. Did you see that?
Oh, yeah. Yep. Sharon Stone.
Tell me she didn't look freaking awesome, right? With that trench coat and that, you know, that slide-swinging big gun. And you're like, oh, my God, that's hot. So the idea for Daybreaker started there, right? I'm like, I wanted a strong female. That's another one. I don't feel like I had a lead, you know, top three female character in the books. And I started building off of there, and I'm like, all right, well, why is she going to be there? What's bringing her in? What is she going to be taking a part of? And, you know, I started thinking of that team of four and stuff like that. And I'm like, okay, what if she was with a group that was a bounty hunting team, right? I got superheroes, which are doing things for the altruistic good, but that's, you know, who does that all the time, right? Every you pay me, right? And
chasing that heroes for hire model.
Yeah. But you know, you throw a bit of that family of four into it, you know. So the concept for her is that her father was a hero who flipped to the other side.
Yeah.
And she's trying to redeem the family name by, you know, going after people that are on the other side. But she's doing it for money. So, oh man, I'm trying to say things without giving away too much.
Yeah, right.
You know, But the Hammer of Prometheus wasn't originally supposed to be the Hammer of Prometheus. The Hammer of Prometheus was supposed to be like an energy hammer.
Yeah.
And just the conceptual design didn't really work. It didn't look good. And one of the guys messing around with me, Andres, excuse me, that he's doing the book right now, was like, you know, all right, let's see what it looks like. You know, a flaming ball of fire. And I'm like, well, visually it looks good. So I went down the rabbit hole, exploring, well, where would that come from? Why would that look that way? You know, and how can I incorporate mythology into it? So then, well, who's Prometheus? Right, the guy who brought fire to the people.
Nice.
How did he do it? And that's where we get the hammer.
That's fantastic.
There's more to it, but I don't want to say it without.
Too
much.
Especially when you got the Kickstarter still running. You got 11 days to go. You're at almost 700 with a 795 goal. So for anybody out there listening, get to it and back immediately.
Thank you. We don't ask for much, you know?
Right.
The book is already made. We're just looking to cover printing costs.
That's fantastic. Absolutely.
You know, we cover printing costs, and that's enough to take us to conventions and stuff like that, where we sell our floppies, and that's where we make the bulk of our money that we put right back into making more dollars.
That's awesome. I want to flip things a little bit. And about a year ago, flipping through Kickstarter, like we were saying earlier, you know, you go to Kickstarter to look for some cool indie comics, and I come across this little title called New York versus the World.
Okay.
Then I see the Unstoppable Comics logo in the corner, and I'm like, oh, come on, wait a minute. Who's messing with my superheroes? Can you talk a little bit about this and talk about what brought New York versus the World to the world?
Yeah, just, you know, flexing my creative muscles, you know, there's not just superhero stories floating around in this big fat head of mine. There's other things out there, and, you know, besides the kung fu action cinema, you know, on Saturday, you also had a lot of horror flicks going on syndicated TV that were heavily edited and stuff like that, but, you know, it's my take on the zombie trope, you know? Zombies are making money. And if you're not trying to take a piece of that zombie pie right now, you're selling yourself short. You know, I mean, look, even Marvel did Marvel Zombies.
Right on.
You know, DC did Blackest Night. I mean, it's there. It's there. Everybody's done it. So it's not a shame to test those waters, and that's what I did. And, well, I'm from New York. Right? So what better place to set it than in New York? But the actual idea came from my neighborhood. So where my mom is at, one of the water treatment facility for Brooklyn is behind my mom's buildings over there. And you drive past it every once in a while, you're like, man, if there was ever a zombie apocalypse, I want to shoot into this place because that looks like a place you can easily defend.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay. So the idea started there, and then I started to expand upon that. Why does it just have to be that one part, you know? And then I'm like, okay, what if it was in Manhattan? Yeah, it was in Manhattan, right? Well, Manhattan is its own island, right? And there's about, on a daily basis, more than 6 million people in Manhattan, right? And about two-thirds of them commute in. So at the end of the day, there's over 1 million, right, close to 2 people that live in Manhattan. All right, so, you know, how you defend the place, right? Well, you blow the bridges and you flood the tunnels. Now nothing is coming in, right? So you have the opportunity to clean out from the center. And that's what they did. And once they cleaned up, they decided, okay, we can let people in, and that's where our story starts.
Yeah.
Now what happens when you let them in? And the scary thing is, you know, you write sometimes what's the low-hanging fruit, right? And xenophobia is big in our country.
Yeah.
You know? So that first issue is a microcosm of that. and for those who don't read it, it's like, you know, what happens if you think somebody is infected and you don't want to let them into a clean zone? What do you do? How do you treat them? And what happens when that goes wrong?
Yeah.
In the Kickstarter, in the preview pages that you had up, you had that really iconic scene from the boat.
And
you definitely get that sense of anticipatory dread.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah. That's the other thing. I could cut loose on that. You know what I mean? Yeah. So the other thing is, all right, with that big show that's out there, you follow a group of people every week, right?
Uh-huh.
And you don't want to lose them. But, you know, I mean, people
got
to
die.
Going down, man. So in this, there's self-contained stories. All right? So the person that you're following in page one may not make it to the end of the book, right? But at the end of the book, do you feel you read a complete tale? And did you follow this person's path? And were you entertained? You know, whether they succeeded in surviving or not. So, in New York versus World, anything can happen, man. Anything can happen.
Did you happen to read any of Guillermo del Toro's books or the TV show that based on his stuff?
The Strain?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Have you followed it?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Do you think that The Strain can learn anything from New York versus the World?
Oh, hell yeah, man. The second season, when they did that whole thing with Staten Island,
yeah.
You know, and Staten Island was a tough bunch. Dude, I don't know. I'm going to piss a lot of people off. Dude, Staten Island is not part of New York. Staten Island is really part of Jersey. Okay? Everybody in New York knows this. All right? Staten Island has been annexed to New Jersey. We don't care about Staten Island. In the 70s was the dump. Was known as the Staten Island dump, right?
Yeah.
The biggest dumping facility, which now got moved to Jersey, for New York Waste, funny enough. But it was known as that. And, well, what happens when you got dead bodies that you can't throw away in New York versus the World? You take them to the dump. dude, if you didn't get hate mail before on this podcast, you guys would have been like, what does the idiot think he's doing, man?
We of the Indie Creator Spotlight would like to formally apologize for the following behaviors and or criticisms.
Yeah, no, I really liked the first season of The Strain, and I felt like I got let down in the second season. And I'm surprised that third season is coming out, because, dude, it was weak. It was weak. It was what he did on Blade 2, and he's bringing his own version of Blade into the series. And I was like, we saw this already, man.
Yeah.
You know, give me something. You are such a better creator. I mean, are you a fan of Guillermo del Toro?
Well, you know, I might just happen to have a giant Pacific Rim robot kind of close by.
Oh, Pacific Rim is great. But did you see Pan's Labyrinth?
Yes. Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
I got myself into a little bit of trouble because when we tried to watch it on the old Blu-ray player, of course, I don't have the subtitles on, and, my wife doesn't speak Spanish.
Okay.
So, of course, 5 minutes in, she looks at me and says, are they going to start speaking so we can understand this? And I'm like, shit. Quick to flip the subtitles back.
But you know what? Did you see Mel Gibson's Apocalypto?
Yes. Yep.
Dude, the first half hour of the movie, there's no subtitles. And for me, I felt like I understood the entire flick. Mm-hmm. I knew everything that was going on. You know, I like watching foreign cinema without the subtitles. I really do.
Yeah.
Did you ever see Brotherhood of the Wolf?
Yes. Oh, my God. Loup de Garou. What a great film.
Great. What? I got the 3-disc DVD collector set.
Oh, my God.
I saw it in the theater. And, you know, I didn't even want to look at the subtitles. He was all in French, and I'm like, I just hit that curse, and I just hit that curse, and that was it.
Yeah, I mean, they had that incredible scene when they're all coming up on the road, and you had the Native American being played by Mark Dacascos, and they have that incredible fight with all those men. And, I mean, even to the point of the big reveal at the end. I mean, it was just such a great film.
But, okay, did you see the deleted scenes on the flick?
No, I have not.
Oh, man. Okay, so when Mark Dacascos and the French guy first get to, what was it, Jungle Dunn? Was that?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, when they first get there, the police, or whatever it was, the militia at that time, they meet them on the road before they get to the town.
Oh, really?
Remember at the very beginning of the flick where the girl was getting tossed in between the two rocks by the monster? Okay, so the militia ends up meeting both of them there. And it's not Mark Dacascos, it's the French guy that kicks their ass.
Really?
Yeah, but that's why you got to get that DVD. So he likes to fall off. Mark Dacascos doesn't even get off the horse. And when you watch the DVD and you listen to the creative commentary, he says, you know what? They needed to take that scene out, even though it is an amazing fight scene, because it takes away from the reveal at the end with him and Vincent Caselli. You know? And
nice.
You would, you got to catch that.
Oh, man, I'm going to have to take a trip to FYE later.
Oh, yeah. My influence comes from everywhere, man. You know, it's not just mythology. And yeah, there's a little bit of Brotherhood of the Wolf incorporated into the Unstoppable Comics universe, man.
Nice.
You know? Yeah, but you know, I try to put Easter eggs as well. So you were talking about New York versus the World a moment ago.
Yes.
If you go back and you look at the Storm Chasers number one Redux, towards the end of the book, when you're taking a walk through Star Striker's gym, you'll be able to notice that the mat underneath his weight bench was the logo, that Biohazard logo, to New York versus the World, was there way back when.
Dude, that's crazy.
Yeah, dude, I try to drop Easter eggs in my stuff too, man.
Nice.
Fantastic. So with us rounding out toward the bottom of the hour, everybody should immediately go out and go to Kickstarter, search for Shield of the Interceptor number 3, give that some funding love. That way we can get definitely more scenes with not only the Interceptor, but with Pride Winter. And let's not forget Daybreaker and that iconic mace, Hammer of Prometheus.
Yeah.
What's next for Unstoppable Comics? Can you guys give us a little teaser about what's about to come down the pipe?
This is almost finished with Interceptor number 4, and that's going to finish up the volume, that first volume.
Mm-hmm.
And that first volume is going to be titled Do Unto Others, if I collect it, into a graphic novel.
Nice.
From that point on, I don't want to say it's not going to be floppy, it's 22 pages, but I want to tell the complete story. Sometimes I feel people don't want to wait, or people don't want to back a book that they don't know if the finale to the tale that they've invested in is going to be there or not. And I understand that. So the next Interceptor tale after this, it's going to be a complete story, and it's going to open up another corner of the Unstoppable Comics universe and dive into what the abilities of the Shield are,
nice.
Not of Interceptor. And that's something that is touched upon or hinted at in Shield of the Interceptor number 3.
Nice.
We are definitely looking forward to more action with the Interceptor and more great things to come from Unstoppable Comics. And we're going to make sure that we post all the links, not only on the YouTube channel, but also when we go audio on the BAMF podcast site.
Oh, that's great.
We put links on every, we'll splash links for all of this stuff and make sure that people can find their way to your comics. But if people want to stalk you on the internet, what's the best way to do that?
All right, well, on Facebook, we're on Unstoppable Comics. On Tumblr, we're on Unstoppable Comics. On Instagram, we're Unstoppable Comics. On Twitter, we're Unstoppable COM. You can't fit comics on there.
Except for Twitter, I'm seeing a trend.
Yeah. And then there's our website, unstoppablecomics.com.
Fantastic. Hey, Jay, I really want to thank you for taking an hour to talk up your comics.
Thank you for your interest in the stuff me and the guys put together, man.
Oh, yeah. It rocks on multiple levels, and at first I was bummed that I didn't get in on the ground floor with the some of the initial offerings, but now that I'm here, I'm kicking off my shoes and planning on staying.
I'm sorry, I forgot. There's one more thing down the pipe.
Tell me.
Before we get to Interceptor number 4, we got 17 pages already done on the Dragonstorm Zero issue redux.
Really?
Yeah, man. That very first Dragonstorm issue came out around the time of the first few Storm Chasers books. You know, I still didn't know what I was doing, but the idea was there. So for those people that stuck with us this long, me and Craig got back on the ball, and there's 17 pages mapped out so far to the 22-page story. I mean,
nice.
Colored and everything, and he's almost done.
Oh, my God.
So hopefully that is up by the end of September, early October.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, rock on, man. Well, that's going to do it for us. Once again, this has been J.D. Rosario talking about his company, Unstoppable Comics. And my name is Walt. You've been listening to the Indie Creator Spotlight, and we're out.